Sergio Perez closes his championship deficit to just 6 points after beating teammate Max Verstappen to victory in Azerbaijan. This is the F1 Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato, and this is round 4, the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. Sergio Perez was at a rare peerless best in Baku, a track he's historically done extremely well at, even if he couldn't show it in qualifying. He started the Grand Prix third behind pole getter Charles Leclerc and teammate Max Verstappen, and once both Red Bull Racing drivers had made pretty easy work of the Ferrari, Perez set about reeling in his teammate. But just before Perez made his first pass attempt, Verstappen made his pit stop, and then the safety car was deployed. Perez got a cheap stop and the lead, and for 38 laps he had to absorb pressure from Verstappen to keep it. But he rose to the challenge, never giving Verstappen a look in and confirming his title challenging credentials. To help run through a race short on spectacle but reasonably weighty with meaning, I'm joined by former head of race strategy at the Haas F1 team, Mike Caulfield. Mike, welcome to the Strategy Report.
Glad you love me. I'm looking forward to this. Unfortunately, not a huge amount to talk about, but in a strategy point of view from the race, but obviously the new format this weekend, so yeah.
Let's start with that format then, because we will get to what little there is to talk about in the race a little bit later on, but it's a good chance to revisit where we are with the sprint format after a couple of years of trials, and also to consider how the tweaks we saw this weekend are affecting the spectacle, or could affect the spectacle going forward as well. This is one of six sprints for the year, and we don't know if there'll be any more rule changes between now and the next one later on in the season. But I mean, from your perspective, having worked on the pit wall as well, I'm interested in the challenge of reducing practice. That seems to be Formula One's aim at this point in time. Stefano Domenicali says he'd prefer to have none, probably need to have at least one. The challenge of compressing 3 hours down to 1 hour, or as it was the case because of Pierre Gasly's fire this weekend, about 45 minutes. How significant is that for teams coming into a weekend like this?
Yeah, I mean, it's fairly significant. I mean, we obviously had the first trial of this, not in terms of the sprint format, but the two-day weekend back in 2020 with Imola, where we did the practice on the Saturday straight into quali and race. And that actually threw up quite a good spectacle in that one. I think the little other parts played a part of it. But it kind of, again, it's with a lot of the rule changes which you make, you're still favouring the kind of big teams. So the teams who have got the very sophisticated simulation tools, they kind of really good simulator packages, huge resource where they can run millions and millions and millions in sims, and they've got the people who are back in the factory who just is their sole job to do that. So they can arrive at a weekend potentially in a much better spot than some of the smaller teams. So when they're trying to get this kind of leveling up of competition, when they make these kind of rule changes, it always affects the smaller teams more than it does the bigger teams. And then especially when kind of maybe teams who've got less parts coming in, who haven't got that kind of turnaround because of budget constraints. I know we've got the budget cap, but there's still a disparity. So again, it puts these extra pressure on the smaller teams who they're not going to risk trialing something because they might break apart and that's the only part they've got. So again, you may be opening up those avenues. So I think in terms of getting it right for the weekend, it favours the big teams. It always will do. I think as we do more of these, if it does continue in this same trend, people start getting into a rhythm and it'll just peter out like everything else, and you'll start seeing what people do, and you start working out kind of how to run a P1 session straight into a sprint quali, etc. Or you might start seeing people using the sprint race as a bit of a test session. If the point system isn't worth it for them, they might actually try and start favouring that to try and get some information for the actual race. So it mixes it up a little bit in that sense. I think in terms from a strategy point of view, it's a bit of a more of level playing field. Everyone has the same historic data coming into it, and then everyone has the same data which you run on a practice session. So in that kind of part, everyone's in the kind of same boat. And probably some teams will read things slightly different to others. So it mixes up a little bit. I think what you'll see more is the difficulties in setup. So I think, and a prime example was Hülkenberg this weekend, where he changed his setup after the sprint race, where he absolutely dropped off after 17 laps in that sprint race and really struggled with the suspension. So made the change and started from the pit lane in the race. Again, it's kind of highlights that you've lack of practice sessions, you're not able to kind of fine tune that setup, especially on a course like Baku as well, which is sometimes quite difficult with the resurfacing coming into this weekend. So it's those little unknowns, but I mean, it's a chat, isn't it, about whether is that the correct thing or not. We want these cars to be the best of the best, but yet they're coming in and actually they're not actually honed by the time they go into Parc Fermé conditions. They're still not an optimum setup, which might make for more exciting racing because the cars aren't in that kind of fine-tuned window. But like I said earlier, that more likely the top teams are going to be in that window and the smaller teams aren't. So that's kind of my opinion on it in that respect.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I was going to ask, because we saw two cars, I mean, it's extremely unusual for Parc Fermé to be broken for anything other than reliability problems, usually things that can't be changed under the regulations. But we got two this weekend, Nico Hülkenberg and Esteban Ocon, just because they felt their setups that they'd landed on after that one session was so wrong that they'd still be better off starting from pit lane and starting from their grid position. So it's pretty unusual in itself. I mean, I'm curious where this interacts with sort of like the regular practice program. You know, we talk a lot about free practice too when we come to kind of guess where the pecking order is and how the cars work over a race distance. We talk about the long runs and that kind of stuff. Is that really the session that's making the difference, let's say, the fact that no one's got time to do that session? And does that sort of suggest that maybe two practice sessions is the way Formula One teams prefer to run, or can that be possibly brought into a single hour of practice, do you think?
Free practice too is definitely the most critical one for a number of factors. So often when you come into P1, the track is obviously very green, so it's not got any grip, so it's already not a representative condition. So like this weekend, you're running in practice one, you're trying to do maybe, if you're trying to look at any high fuel, it's not really representative for what the race condition is going to be. So there's little grip on the car, so you can't really tune your setup on this. This is why normally in a practice one session, you'll see that first 10, 20 minutes, cars just going out and doing the aero tests and doing slight tweaks and just checking the reliability, doing the systems checks, because the track is just not in any way representative for the rest of the weekend. Obviously, by the time you've got that kind of practice one done, you then get into practice two on a normal weekend. For a start, the track's rubbered in a little bit. And then secondly, it's similar conditions in terms of weather, time of day, to what the race is going to be run in most cases. So again, you've got a similar track temperature, you've got a similar kind of air temperature. So you're already then more in that kind of window of how the race is going to be run. So it's much more kind of dialed in and what you can use for that race information. So that's really why FP2 is the critical one. And again, like you go to FP3 on a normal weekend, and again, it's in the morning, and it's you're doing your quali prep. There's not as much information you can gain out of that session. The track often resets overnight to a certain extent, so you lose a little bit of grip once it goes through the conditions changes. And yeah, so that's why FP2 is really your most important one.
McLaren using all of the soft tyres before sprint qualifying on Saturday was a minor talking point, because Lando Norris did make sprint qualifying where he didn't have any tyres to use. What was your thought on that approach? And I guess that speaks to where the teams really see, I mean, the big points are obviously on Sunday, but where the teams really see the point of the weekend still is, despite Saturday being carved out as its own little miniature event.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I'm actually surprised there weren't more cars who did the same thing. I think apart from like what we class as the top four teams now, so yeah, Red Bull, Ferrari, Mercedes, Aston Martin, almost those top eight positions are gone now. So for like someone like Lando, even if he had a set of tyres left for that kind of sprint qualifying, his best he could probably hope for is eight. Oh, nine for 10. So in the end, he finishes 10th for not running, and he maybe gains one position if it all goes smoothly. So obviously, and in that place, you're sat in 9th or 10th, and then you struggle, you fight in that sprint races for a point. You might hope to get 8th or 7th if someone up in front of you kind of crashes out. So I think the top four teams will run it as normal, but yeah, the other teams are going to be looking for maximizing qualifying. So if they need to use five sets of tyres in qualifying to get their ultimate position, then they'll use five sets of tyres. So I expect there'll be a change in that before the next sprint race, either that used tyres are allowed to be run in the sprint qualifying sessions, or that you have to keep a set of softs for that third qualifying session. I think in my eyes, should just be allowed to run used tyres. It offers that extra strategic element. There'll be some circuits where actually a used tire keeps its performance, so you can actually kind of bed it in and run it again in that, especially those medium tires. And yeah, like I said, for a car like Lando or most of the midfield, even if they get into like SQ3, they're going to struggle to get into that top eight anyway, regardless of what tyres they've got left. If they've got a new tyre or a used tyre or no tyres, they're going to be probably 9th or 10th. So I'm not surprised that they did that. And I don't think it was a oversight on their part. And I think if you'd seen other midfield teams getting into the third qualifying sessions, say like a team like Haas or something, and then they'd have probably been in a similar position, but they'd have used all their softs to get into Q3 in normal qualifying and wouldn't have had any left for the Saturday one.
You mentioned earlier the idea that compressing this practice time really meant teams had to think about, and particularly the smaller teams, bringing upgrades, that kind of thing, how they approach the overall season in terms of development. I thought it was really interesting, and quite a number of other people did as well, that Alpine brought a fairly significant upgrade to this weekend. So did McLaren. I guess you could say two quite contrasting fortunes there. But considering the way Alpine's weekend went, which I think we can only describe as a worst case scenario for bringing an upgrade, are you surprised that teams did try it, considering this is only one of six weekends? Not as if we do this every weekend, the sprint.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, because you've obviously got two opportunities to score points, and if you think it's a significant upgrade, then you obviously want to get it on the car as quick as possible. And then, but yeah, I mean, it's Baku's obviously not one in the traditional sense you'd tend to look for bringing upgrades to, just because the chance of crashes or accidents. You've got Miami coming up next, which is also a street circuit, so then you're putting it off to Imola. So it's, in this kind of case, with the midfield being so tight, I don't think teams can really afford to put off upgrades if they've got them ready in that sense. So yeah, but in terms of Alpine's weekend, it's I mean, you couldn't have helped much worse to try and get a good read on it. And I know Otmar came out after the session saying all the numbers looked right, but I'm not sure really where he gathered that from, considering how little time they had running on tracking that first session. But I was a little bit surprised, but at the same time, I think it's just the nature of the sport now, but if they're ready, you've got to put them on the car.
Ready to up your game and learn more about the thrilling world of sports betting? Introducing Double Down with Breslow, the ultimate podcast about the business of sports gambling. Join me, James Breslow, and a long list of expert guests as we dive into the art and science of the sports betting industry. Evolving regulations, technology enhancements, and the meteoric rise in the number of players makes this sector the fastest growing and most intriguing in the world. Unlock the business secrets from many of the industry's most recognizable C-suite executives, including famous odds makers and influencers. Every episode of Double Down with Breslow is packed with insider tips, deeply skilled analysis, and in-depth discussions. Don't miss out on the ultimate resource for mastering the business of sports betting. Listen to Double Down with Breslow on the Evergreen Podcast Network or wherever you listen to podcasts. That's Double Down with Breslow, the business of sports betting podcast.
Do you think we've arrived somewhere closer to what might be the final version of this? It's an ongoing tweak. It continues to be a trial. Could be a trial forever, for all we know. But what's your feeling on the model they've ended up for this weekend?
I understand why they've gone to it coming into the weekend, but my thoughts based on this weekend are not based on what happened on the track. But it just felt, for me, a little bit disjointed. Just the kind of case of you having practice and quali on Friday, and then a whole new thing on the Saturday, and then back to the race. And I don't know. For me, it just felt a little bit, a little bit disjointed in saying having qualified so far away from the race and then nothing going into that, and then that Saturday being totally separate. So I don't know if that'll be looked about. I know, obviously, in time zones, a little bit different, but there was a lot of complaints over here as well by the fact that qualifying was at 2 p.m. on a Friday afternoon when most people are at work or at school. So it's not great in terms of that one. And I think more people would prefer to watch the actual qualifying than watching the sprint qualifying or the sprint race. So I don't know if that'll be thought about. Obviously, you can't ever please the entire world are watching it, and I don't know if it's more catered, but even so, trying for American fans, if they're looking at that market, you're looking at 7 a.m. or 8 a.m. for them for qualifying. So it still doesn't really hit the button on that aspect. But in terms of the kind of structure of it, I agree with the sprint race being separate from the actual event. I wasn't ever kind of a huge fan of the sprint the sprint or the sprint race, setting the grid for the actual race. Because you saw occasions like in Brazil last year where Kev Magnussen had a great qualifying, put it on pole on Friday, but then did the sprint, but that was then decided on pole for the sprint race. By the time that ended, I think he was 7th or 8th. And then, so actually, once it comes to the race, it's kind of all shuffled out in performance order anyway. So you kind of have that mix-up of the grid's already gone. And once the race comes, it's you're all in performance order, where qualifying obviously adds that little bit of a lottery. Sometimes you can, red flags happen, you can clip the wall, so you can create that mixed-up grid. So I prefer that qualifying's now gone back for setting the grid for the actual race. I just don't know if the order of the doing things could maybe be improved slightly. I know one thing I've talked about with a couple of people is, I don't know if you keep the same format as we have now, but you have the sprint qualifying on the Friday evening and then have the sprint race on the Saturday morning before going back into kind of a normal qualifying schedule Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening before the race on the Sunday. I think the only downside to that is potentially that you get a crash in the sprint race, which leaves you unable to compete in the qualifying. But really, I think that's no different than having a big shunt in P3 and getting the cars turned around and into qualifying either. And in this aspect as well, you have the sprint race where it'd be at a different time of day to what the actual race would be. So different conditions, like we mentioned earlier, you're in potentially totally different track temperatures. The track's a bit kind of greener. So it opens that up to maybe a little bit of a kind of and not as normal race in that respect. So I think we're getting that. My gut feeling is they're going to, now they've separated the sprint out from the actual race, they'll try and broach the subject of reverse grids again at some point. I'm not sure how that'll work, but I imagine that will come up again. Now they're kind of, the biggest kind of pushback against the reverse grids for the initial sprint was that, it was like places like Baku, if you adhere to this weekend, they were reverse grid, you'd really struggle to get back up to kind of a normal position for the race, and the race would be jungle, and it's just a bit of a lottery. Whereas now it's separated out from the race, I think people might be more open to trialing that at least. But who knows? I don't make the decisions on that.
Reverse grids always come up. That, along with the Grand Prix in London, and well, I was going to say Nico Hülkenberg coming back, but he'd come back. So I guess, well, you know, got one out of three. Maybe we'll get to reverse grids. Who knows? Question for another day. I want to look at the battle for the lead now, as much as we had a battle. I don't actually want to start with Red Bull just yet, though. I want to look first at Ferrari, because it was something of a morale-boosting weekend, I suppose, for Ferrari, considering Leclerc got two pole positions. He's been close-ish up until now, but realistically, we've never thought that Ferrari really had that kind of pace to get it done. He did get it done, and that kind of tallies, I suppose, with what Frederik Vass's been saying all season, isn't it? That somewhere in that car, somewhere deep inside it, it does have pace, it just needs to be set up. Do you feel like what we saw in these two qualifying sessions validates that? And do you think that that can actually eventually translate it to being a quicker racing car?
I mean, this is it's a difficult question in terms of, I think that Ferrari definitely has one lap pace, but I think potentially the reason it has its one lap pace is because it's detrimental to its race pace on how it like gets the tyres in that correct window. Obviously, somewhere like Baku, it being a smooth circuit, not much energy goes into it. If you've got a car which is kind of tough on its tyres, it generally leads it into a position where it's actually quite good for a qualifying attempt, because it means the tyres are already in the window, whereas other people are having to work harder. But then obviously, once that comes into a race and you're doing into consecutive laps, it's going to be tough on the tyres. So maybe that kind of, it's a compromise, but if they improve the race pace, I think the qualifying pace will drop a little bit. And you look at how far they are off the Red Bull in that kind of race pace. I mean, what was it? I think Perez was over 20 seconds ahead of Leclerc by the end of the race. I think that kind of gap is just, it's going to be very difficult to close down. I mean, I agree, though. It's good to have that battle in qualifying, and there'll be some circuits, especially like, say, somewhere like Monaco. If you stick it on pole in Monaco, then regardless of your race pace, you can drive around there at 5 seconds off the pace. You're not going to be overtaken. So there will be opportunities coming in the season, and different circuits will probably offer different chances in that respect. But looking at kind of how much they struggle with the tyres so far, especially the softer ones, I think it showed when they got onto the harder compound, they were better. But unfortunately, they generally come obviously with a little bit less pace. So it's that kind of balance again, that they can't seem to make the softer compounds last in a race situation.
Yeah, I think it was Fernando Alonso who was chasing Charles Leclerc who noted that, the fact that on the harder tyre and with a little bit of cooler weather towards the end of the race, a little bit of shade, the Ferrari didn't have quite as severe tyre wear as you'd seen on the medium tyre. So definitely there's a key in there. You mentioned that race pace for Red Bull. They absolutely breezed past. The second DRS was allowed, Max Verstappen was through, Sergio Perez was through two laps later. The speed difference was something like 30 kilometres an hour with the DRS open, pretty significant. But there was then a battle for the lead between Sergio Perez and Max Verstappen, what I think we all hoped, given that Perez has either... Well, he has earned it, but has also very much been willingly given this title of being very good on street tracks. And he is, and he's very good at Baku, to be fair to him. He closed in right on Verstappen in those early laps before we got to that safety car that kind of flipped everything around. But I want to talk about that thinking period just before that Verstappen pit stop. Because I think the decision-making is maybe even a little bit more interesting than it seemed at the time. Verstappen was struggling a bit with his tyres, called in at the end of lap 10, just before it seemed like Perez perhaps was going to pass him, either that lap or maybe the lap after. And of course, in a battle of only two drivers with one team, we often think about the car in the lead getting pit stop priority, all that kind of stuff does actually change things inside a team. How much do you think that played into the decision-making to pit Max, regardless of what was going on with Nyck de Vries, the fact that there was this intra-team battle on Red Bull's hands?
I mean, I've gone back and, reviewed this one, and it does seem strange. It surprised me. Like, Red Bull are usually kind of nailed on with their strategy, and, like, with the amount of people they have in their team as well, you're looking back at they'll have 20-odd people probably back at the kind of factory in Milton Keynes who are reviewing videos, who are looking at this. And the minute that double yellow comes out, you look at that incident and you think, there's a high chance of a safety car here. Just with the nature of Baku, the only ones is, like, if it's gone down a runoff, okay, generally that'll be safe. You can, maybe that won't turn into a full safety car, but you instantly saw when De Vries went off, even before the video cuts were, the teams have access to kind of the onboard, so they could quickly have gone and looked at this. And then I think when that WL came out, Verstappen's only at turn 15. But the fact is, as well, is how they're thinking and how they're operating, which I obviously don't know, but are they two separate entities? Are they, like, is there a Verstappen versus Perez? Not versus, but, like, are they saying? Because in the grand scheme of things for the team, for the constructors, there was no benefit of pitting Verstappen, even if Perez had overtaken him that very straight, if Verstappen hadn't pitted, they would have been no worse off if the safety car had come out that lap. Whereas if Verstappen pits and the safety car comes out as it did, then he's always going to be a disadvantage. So it seems a really strange decision, that fact that it was a high chance of a safety car, but they didn't, like, kind of clock that it was a high chance of a safety car, and at least give Verstappen the chance to defend down the straight on that lap to see if the safety car was going to come out. And then with the gap ahead to Leclerc behind, also knowing that Leclerc would have stopped anyway, they would have had time to double stack the cars, both Verstappen and Perez, and leave them as one and two. And again, worst case scenario on that one, if there's slight delay in the pit stop, Perez comes out in third, and we saw how easy he overtook the first time round. So after the restart, I don't think it would have been any issue getting through anyway. So it was a really strange decision process in that one. It kind of, especially for a team like Red Bull, who are normally really on it with the strategy, but you saw where De Vries went off. As soon as the camera cut to it, there was plenty of time for that decision making. It wasn't like they were coming down the main straight and Verstappen had already committed to the pits, and obviously the race director's note meant once you've committed, you can't come in. He was at turn 15, so there's still two corners when to go before two corners and a long 2 kilometer straight to go before he was entering the pit. So it really surprised me that they didn't keep him out on that lap, regardless of what going, because from a team point of view, they weren't going to lose out either way. I know obviously Verstappen dropped back and he got through anyway, but gives Perez the win. So yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting dynamic, but on how that happened, and I'm not quite sure. But Verstappen himself would be particularly happy with it, with the call. But yeah, that's how it goes sometimes.
Clearly, there must have been other things making him more unhappy over the course of the weekend that he didn't seem to speak out about it too much. So maybe they were lucky things didn't go quite his way during the sprint, kept everything calm. It's going to be so much focus on that decision-making, isn't there, this year? If they do end up being title contenders, both of them, or one of them is going to be, I guess if Sergio Perez is the question I'm asking here, really, he's going to be the title contender, then the focus on co-decisions like that are going to be so much more acute. I thought it was interesting, Christian Horner mentioned a couple of times, particularly after the race, when he was talking about the way they were managing their drivers, that he kept thinking about the 2018 Azerbaijan Grand Prix when Daniel Ricciardo and Max Verstappen hit one another. From your perspective on the pit wall, how much does that kind of, I guess, organisational memory, if you like, play into future decisions, considering he was dealing with two different drivers, relatively different scenario, if in fact that was in the back of their minds making decisions? Is that common, or is it really much more of the moment when you're making decisions like this?
It's a bit of both. So obviously I was with Mercedes in 2016 when we had the Lewis and Nico battle, and obviously the seasons prior to that as well. So it does become a stressful environment in terms of not just from the driver's point of view, but obviously you've got teams within teams there, but the strategists involved in the team are kind of, they're just looking for the best team result. So you kind of have your, I don't know what Red Bull have, but like at Mercedes, the kind of rules of engagement. So like you say, lead car gets the pit stop preference, lead car gets this, etc. You try not to fight each other on the track too much, but obviously if you're open to fight, but be sensible. Obviously we saw in Barcelona 2016 and a couple of other occasions between those two, it doesn't happen. So it is in the back of your mind that the worst case scenario is that, yeah, your two cars take each other out. But as you say, the worst thing that happens to that is obviously you chuck away 40 odd points. But I mean, the position Red Bull are in, I think they're so dominant that even if that did happen, it's not the end of the world. But you is always at the back of your mind that it's the worst thing to happen. It's really not a good publicity. It creates more unrest in the team because blame will be assigned, sometimes correctly, sometimes incorrectly, to one person if they do hit each other. And you want to try and keep as harmonious kind of relationship between your two drivers, even if they are competing as well, because it can spiral.
Let's wrap up the race a little bit more broadly now, considering the, I guess, spectacle we got. We've talked about the sprint race in particular and what that did to the course of the weekend, let's say, how teams changed their preparations. But it's hard to avoid the perception, certainly, that people were disappointed walking away from this weekend because they didn't get what they expected, which was something quite wacky, which seems to be the reputation of Azerbaijan. Passing seemed harder than, well, it usually is here, and certainly harder than expected, particularly on Sunday. Is it just down to being one of those races, similar to Australia, I guess, where everyone stopped behind an early safety car and just turned into a management race? Or do you think there are other issues at play here?
Yeah, I think it's two aspects of it. Is the fact that, yeah, the stop, everyone on the same age tyres always has a kind of consequence of it. So everyone stopping under that safety car and basically fitting the tyres made things difficult to pass it. I think as well is it's actually a consequence of the grid closing up because teams aren't having that kind of lap time delta required to pass now. So even with DRS, you get these DRS trains formed. But because the kind of midfield's split by about 2-3 temps, it's not enough to overtake it. So you don't get that kind of passing. And with the tyres, there's no drop-off on the tyres. You're not kind of getting that kind of corner exit. I think with obviously Baku, the fact that you have the last corner is so far before the actual kind of all right, you get the kind of yeses, but they're not real corners in an F1 car. So you're not kind of getting like that kind of close following out for corner, then being on someone who's on older tires, you might begin to get a little runoff down the straight, kind of going following through those S's, you can't follow that closely. So I think that's a little bit to it. I saw a couple of people saying that DRS had been shortened by 100 meters and that made things worse. And I was like, but then a few races ago, DRS was too easy for overtaking, so people can't win on this. And I think I found it interesting in as much as it can be interesting, but like you had a car like Hulkenberg and Ocon who were obviously on 10 lap older tires and people weren't able to overtake them. And I thought that was kind of a fairly good battle in that respect, because it just showed that the all right, that kind of tyre delta wasn't there, but that DRS isn't super powerful. You need to, but it's also a challenge for the engineers to make the cars kind of that slippery. But even without DRS, you can still got that pace to try and prevent cars from overtaking you. But yeah, it's not what Baku's expected, but I think occasionally you're going to get races like this. I mean, that's the nature of sport, isn't it? Unfortunately, but you will get some dull races. And yeah, like you said, that safety car almost fell at a almost perfect time for everyone to stick the tires on. The hard tire was probably too conservative for Baku, with it being a street circuit, but then the soft was too poor. So I don't know. Is the tire selection we've got at the moment just that little bit? Yeah, I don't know. It's we're not getting kind of the right tires for the right races at the moment, which is a little bit of a shame. You just needed that soft to be that little bit more usable, and then you maybe have some potential to kind of mix the strategies up a bit. But again, the hard was just could last the whole race. Again, you needed the hard to be 10-15 laps shorter in terms of length, so you actually need the tires to be closer together in terms of performance. So there is that kind of variety in strategies. But yeah, with the hard, I think some people would, like potentially with Hulkenberg and Ocon, who started on the hard and you saw where they got to, I think potentially if there'd been a lap on safety car, they'd have cycled their tires and gone back onto the hard and then just done the full race on it. I think that was the kind of view with the hard tire, that it could just last. It wasn't going to degrade. So I think it's just one of those weekends, unfortunately, for I don't think it's anything consequence. It's going to happen. You're never going to have 24, 23 races who are all fantastic slam dunk. I think Baku's obviously offered up some chaos in the past and everybody suddenly expects just because it is. But I think everyone got the crashes out of the system in the qualifying and practice sessions in the lead up to it. And then everyone's a bit more cautious going into this race.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like that. So an interesting weekend overall, even if the Grand Prix itself didn't offer us too much of a spectacle, but they're not all going to be winners at the end of the day. Only Sergio Perez was the winner. Mike, a real pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. No, that was really good fun. Cheers.
Is Sergio Perez really a title challenger? Well, at two of four races so far this season, he's genuinely had the measure of Max Verstappen on race pace, even if good luck cemented victories in Jeddah and Baku. If he can do it again, and on a track that isn't a street circuit, then it'll be hard to discount him as a genuine chance to take this fight all the way. Thanks very much to Mike Caulfield for joining me. You can subscribe to The Strategy Report wherever you get your favourite podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a rating and a review to help spread the word. You can also find us on social media. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network. Special thanks to Ben Loke from Bloke Designs for the show artwork, and our theme music is by Simon Hosford. My name's Michael Laminato, and I'll catch you next week for the Miami Grand Prix.
Hey there, and welcome to the Joy of Paddle podcast, hosted by me, Minter Dial, a veteran of the paddle tennis world, and sponsored by Paddle 1969. Whether you're a paddle tennis aficionado, just beginning, or have never even heard of paddle, or paddle, as it's called in North America, this is an exhilarating new show that delves into the captivating stories of notable paddle personalities worldwide. In its inaugural season, you'll be treated to exclusive anecdotes, valuable tips, life lessons, and humorous moments shared by esteemed professional paddle players, industry insiders, and passionate paddle enthusiasts. With each season aligning with the Pro Tour, you can anticipate two engaging episodes per month. The Joy of Paddle podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, where you can find other great shows in a number of categories, such as sports, health and wellness, true crime, and fiction. To find out more about Evergreen Podcasts, go to www.evergreenpodcast.com. Vamos!